What's driving national growth in all industries from one of the country's most dynamic regions?
Welcome to Strategic Compass, our new podcast exploring the strategic forces shaping the future of business. I'm Patrick Ryan, KPMG's National Managing Partner, Advisory Strategy and Markets.
And I'm Kathy Hollinger, CEO of the Greater Washington Partnership. We are thrilled to sit down with the region's most influential leaders to hear their stories of bold ideas, collaboration, and leadership shaping the economy from Baltimore through Washington, D.C., all the way to Richmond and nationally.
And as we dive into these conversations, we'll uncover how Greater Washington area CEOs are driving national conversations. And now, I look forward to hearing from Kathy as she guides us through the story of how it all began, and more importantly, where we go from here.
Welcome to Strategic Compass, a podcast about bold leadership and big bets. I'm Kathy Hollinger, CEO of the Greater Washington Partnership.
This series is about lifting the leaders whose ideas and perspectives are shaping the economic future of our region in Maryland, D.C., and Virginia. What makes the region so distinctive and truly what makes our work as an organization so energizing is the depth and reach of our leaders at our table. They are leaders who think globally, many operate nationally and globally, but they're right here. They're in our region, and they are deeply committed to the future growth of this region. So today's episode is just one of those conversations that reminds you of why collective leadership matters. We're joined by Mark Weinberger, one of the most respected voices at the intersection of business and public policy. He is the former global chairman and CEO of EY. He's an advisor and has been to four U.S. presidents, a founding partner in the creation of the Greater Washington Partnership. And he brings the kind of global perspective and real world policy experience that is really essential to understanding long-term economic competitiveness. And then stepping in to lead today's conversation is someone who conveniently knows Mark very well, which is why it's going to be a great conversation, but really was instrumental in helping build the partnership from day one. Peter Scheer, vice chairman of JPMorgan Chase. He has been a defining voice on economic growth, workforce development, and the role that private sector plays in communities and cities nationally, globally, and of course here in the region. He brings decades of experience working across business, government, and civic leadership, and has such great experience to make conversations like this both candid but consequential. So what you are going to hear today is less of a formal interview. It's going to be a real exchange, I would say, fairly between two friends, two peers who have been in the same arena, who understand what's at stake and who cares so deeply about the future of this region and this country. And that's really why we created this platform. It's to surface the kind of leadership thinking that's in play with the two of you, but really to help us all see around the corners and lead with intention. So, Peter, thank you for guiding this one. And listeners, you are in for a real treat.
So as Kathy said, the Greater Washington Partnership brought together a group of partners and leaders who are committed to the region, you know, focused on how do we actually work together, how business can play a more active role in addressing challenges, creating greater opportunity. As Kathy said, one of the leaders from the start of this over 10 years ago is Mark Weinberger, who has also been a great friend and mentor to me, although it makes it sound like you're much older and wiser. I'm actually 3 months older than you. I have a lot of wisdom out of that 3 months. But Mark, you and I actually both kind of started generally in the same place, short stint in the private sector, and then we actually met on Capitol Hill more than 35 years ago. You gave me one of the most important pieces of advice about someone to hire. But you started at EY and then quickly went, you know, within 3 years, I think, went into the public sector. Talk about your early career and sort of how you thought about it and what some of the lessons that you learned from the earliest parts of your career in both accounting and in public policy?
Well, sure, Peter. It's great to be here with you, of all people, obviously. I have always looked up to you and enjoyed working with you. So it was really interesting, Peter. I think I learned from day one a big lesson when I started with EY. I was a gym rat and not a great student, and I wanted to go play basketball, and my good friend was going to interview, and he said, you come with me to our interviews, and I'll go play basketball with you. I did. I went and interviewed at a bunch of firms. One of them was called Ernst & Winnie at the time. I thought it was a law firm. I had no idea it was an accounting firm. I interviewed there only because he was going to come play basketball, and got a job doing tax returns over the summer. And fast forward like 100 years, and I've become chairman and CEO of the firm. And I met my wife there, even more importantly. So just getting up and being there was just something I learned from day one, that if I didn't get off the couch and he didn't want to take me there, I never would have found the place.
And did you ever imagine when you were 25 or in your mid-20s that this is where you would end up?
No, actually, Peter, I left three times, and I joined the firm four times, which is odd for a ultimately a CEO who, by the way, wasn't a CPA. So Right. Lots of crazy stuff.
And it's actually one of the many things I realized right in common. I was not a great student either. I actually ended up in this region at American University because it was actually the only school to accept me. So it made my decision about where to go to school quite easy. I would never get in there today. But as you think about your career in the private sector and the public sector, what are sort of the commonalities of what you feel has made you successful?
Well, many things in terms of people I've learned from along the way. I mean, really, it's what I learned. You learn in school, Peter, obviously, you know, is you got your grades, you've got your scores on your tests, and how well do you do individually, and then you get ranked and all these things, and then you get into either jobs or another school. And when you get to the work world, it's so much more important to make others look good than to yourself, because what you realize pretty quickly is there's nothing more important than the team, and people want you on your team if they succeed because of you. So I learned pretty early on that it wasn't about necessarily me doing the best job, but me helping others to do their job. And over time, that gives you tremendous opportunities. And I got to work on all these great projects and learn things that, you know, if I just worked by myself, it probably would have been maybe learning a lot of technical things, but not the mentorship, all the things that during the COVID period, other things that when you talk about working at home, you miss if you're not in the office.
And I know you and I have talked a lot about it. In fact, one of the things that actually makes others, you know, look good and perform better is telling the truth. And even when it's uncomfortable and awkward, and I know you have a story about having to tell the truth in the Oval Office to the President of the United States. But I think it's important because I think, you know, particularly the times we're living in, it's so complex. A lot of people just sort of go along and say, well, someone's decided to do something, and don't raise their hand and say, wait a second, I'm not sure that makes sense. So, and that whether you're in business or in politics or government, it's equally important. Talk about how you have had to face that kind of challenge.
I will. And to your point, it was so interesting because I learned so many things in government that translated well to business that I really, really suggest that people think broadly about their career opportunities. So, yeah, I think what you're referring to is the opportunity when I was in the Oval Office. And at that time, we were having an economic downturn.
And this was under President Bush.
This was President Bush. Yeah, one of the four presidents I had the privilege of working under. We were trying to get, in order to get Democrats and Republicans on board, and we needed to have a tax cut to help stimulate the economy, but then write checks. And we hadn't written checks at the federal government in 30 years, since the Carter administration, and it was done by the Department of Defense. And so we're sitting in the Oval Office. There's about 30 people. It's the first time I met the president. It was one of my first meetings with him. And I was in the back row and said, just don't say anything, they said to me, when you go in there. And you had the vice president, the secretary, and Larry Lindsey, and Glenn Hubbard, and a whole bunch of people, economic advisors. And the president asked the secretary, when are we going to get the checks out because people are hurting? And the secretary said, well, we are going to work really hard. We're going to get those out in 3 to 6 weeks. And it was my job to get the checks out as Assistant Secretary of Treasury and Tax Policy. And I knew it would be 3 to 6 months. And I didn't know what I should do. And so I did something, obviously, anybody would do. I raised my hand in the Oval Office.
Right.
And first people did was look at me and say—
I don't know that anyone would necessarily be in the Oval Office, but that's a good rule to know. If you're in the Oval Office, raise your hand.
Actually, you don't. People looked at me and said, like, why is he raising his hand? Like, what is, and who is he, by the way? And the president, to his credit, looked back and said yes, and he didn't know me at the time. I said, Mr. President, Secretary is absolutely right. We need to get these checks out as soon as possible. It's likely, however, they have to be watermarked. We have to find people's addresses. Back then, we didn't have technology. This was in the early 2000s like we do. It may take 3 to 6 months. Silence. Not what anybody wanted to hear. And of course, my boss, the secretary, just said something different to the president. I swear to this day, I don't know if it's true, Peter, the president was sitting back in his desk and he used to wear his glasses down over his nose. And I swear he winked at me, but I don't know that. In any way, the secretary went on to say, well, that's what the bureaucrats are saying, but we're going to get them out. I go back to my office thinking, first of all, I'm fired because right. It's longer than it should take. And my secretary, my boss, is probably mad at me. Well, first of all, to Secretary O'Neill's credit, he never uttered a word about me contradicting him. And that taught me is that it is okay for others to speak up and disagree with you in public. And that was a great lesson, as a leader, a great lesson to learn about people who work with you. You want them to voice their opinion. We did not want the most powerful man in the world going out and making a press conference and saying the checks will be out in 3 weeks if it would have taken 6 months, and he knew that. Secondly, Secretary Card, who was the chief of staff at the time, called me after the meeting, and to his credit, I didn't know literally if I was being fired. I've never met and talked to Secretary Card. I'm in my office. I get the phone call, and the secretary said that President Bush would really want you to be in all his economic policy meetings because he knows you'll tell him the truth. And from that, it just changed my confidence in meetings and career path and really taught me what you said, Peter, which is that, boy, if he, the President of the United States, valued someone disagreeing with him and speaking up and telling the truth, that's what I need if I'm ever going to get anywhere.
And you want to, and in a way, listen, when I talk to a lot of young people, I know you talk to a lot of young people, you want to work with people who appreciate that candor and appreciate the truth. Because there are some leaders who may not want that, and that's a decision you kind of make when you're charting your own career path, to work with leaders like that.
Absolutely. And it went all the way, you know, we'll get there, but when I was CEO, and you have to lead authentically because you cannot remember all the things you say to people. You better be telling the truth. But even there, I would just say, at the time, I didn't realize the impact it would have on me, and it did for all the reasons you suggest.
And to give you confidence just to be true to yourself.
Absolutely. And one other thing I will tell you about my career path, because it was an odd one, right? Joining EY four times, you know, working in the Senate, starting my own firm for 7 years and working for a bunch of presidents. What got me through that, first of all, it's my partner in life. When I first went to work for President Bush, we had four kids under 6 years old. Some were friends with your kids, so you know how it is working in the government with four kids under six. That we didn't have at that point very much means. And so you need to make that commitment. That is really a commitment to service, and you need a partner to do that. But my father, every time I got a new role, whether I got promoted at EY, whether I got the assistant secretary role, he never got to see me be chairman and CEO of EY. I would call him and tell him, I'm really excited I got this promotion. He'd say the same thing every time. I love you no matter what your title is.
So nice.
Just never forget who you are, where you came from. When you have that feeling inside, which I know you do, Peter, then all you have to please is yourself.
Right.
You're not doing it for someone else. It is so much easier to make decisions that are not gray, but just what's good for you.
Right. My father used to say, that's nice, but how are the kids?
Right.
As a way to remind you, all this stuff is great and it's nice and you can be doing all kinds of interesting and powerful things, but at the end of the day, it's about your kids. So
that's great. You're a great dad. I've seen you.
So let's talk about, we've both been at this intersection of government and business. And I think over the last really 5 to 10 years, the role of companies and business in public policy has really been evolving. And there's a view right now, companies can't just be thinking about the next quarter profits, but thinking longer term about not only how to invest and build their companies, but how to invest and build the communities in which they operate. How have you seen that evolution over the last few years?
So it's a really interesting point. From a public perception standpoint, it's changed quite a bit. It swings one way or the other based upon how extreme sometimes policymakers take us in government. But I will tell you, you remember back to the days when I was on the Business Roundtable with Jamie, and you were there all the time, and we came up with the stakeholder capitalism announcement that basically in order to have long-term shareholder value, you need to take care of all of your stakeholders, meaning your communities, your employees, your customers. You de-risk your long-term value and share price when you have those great relationships. And so I, from day one, believe that great leaders have always focused on their employees, their communities, their supply chains, their partnerships, and the shareholder value that creates, not just that long-term value. One of the problems we have today is who is your shareholder? Because we have a lot of people who hold your stock for a minute. We have a lot of traders. We have a lot of people who push you, activists who may come in for short term. But I believe that this long-term value creation is the compass that you have to have as a leader and as a board member on several boards, including our company, JP Morgan, where we both are working. That long-term creation of value has served us. That concept of fortress balance sheet serves us through every good and bad, thick and thin. And I know you've seen that as well, both in your government roles and in your business roles.
Well, and it's been, interesting because I don't think we traditionally in business, we've done a very good job to how we talk about it, because I think it's often seen as, oh, this is a little hobby we do on the side for PR or to kind of burnish our image. But the fact is, as you say, these are things that have to be talked about and have to be thought about in the context of long-term shareholder value. As you know, we've made, enormous investments in Detroit over the last 10 years at a point that the city was in bankruptcy. And a lot of shareholders and a lot of our analysts and investors questioned why we were doing that. The fact is that, we invested $200 or $300 million in helping bring the city back. Our business has grown exponentially. Our deposits are up by over $30 billion. Our accounts are up. There are more people working. There are more customers. And the fact is, it is not only not inconsistent, it actually supports long-term shareholder value for our firm.
Absolutely. It is not purpose or profit. It's purpose and profit. And to your point, when you think about what JP Morgan, in this case, what it does, if you think about not what its financial statement is, but the loans we create to let people buy houses and buy cars and to buy food. And that, as you say, the localities that we create where you can build supermarkets and people could create jobs, that when your employees think about what they're doing to other than make money, but to fulfill a need, they are more engaged. And when I was at EY, Peter, we did a lot of data analytics about our engagement scores of how engaged our people were and how they felt about what they were doing, and tying it to our ultimate profitability and quality by business unit. And there was a direct correlation, more so than your financial numbers, which are a trailing indicator. They just tell you what you did.
Right. Well, in particular, and we'll talk a little bit about workforce, but particularly as we're all competing for talent, people, young people in particular, but people want to be proud and want to feel that the companies they're working for, the firms they're working for, are contributing positively to some of the challenges in society.
Absolutely. And to your point, the two or three questions that correlated the best were, are you proud to work at X? In this case, it was EY. 75% of our people, we had 300,000 people, were millennials. If you were proud to work at EY and you felt like you could bring yourself to work and you felt like you understood the strategy and where you were going, those three questions alone, your engagement was very high. And ultimately, that translated into business results.
So I know, Mark, you advise, formally and informally, a lot of CEOs, just given the roles you've played. Engaging in the government political process can be complicated. It's very, the environment's very challenging. I think a lot of CEOs thought, let's just stay below the radar screen, which is hard to do. How do you advise your CEOs to navigate a political process and a political climate that can be very challenging?
Exactly the opposite of what you just said most CEOs would think, because my view has always been, I'd much rather be in the room trying to contribute and tell the policymakers what effect their policies are having on my workers, my customers, my communities, than outside the room complaining. And it is very hard for a lot of CEOs who don't grow up in Washington to translate their business and the policies there and then want to go and do that. You've navigated both extremely successfully when you were in the Senate, and then, of course, when you were in the administration with trade, and then back at JP Morgan. But most CEOs don't do that. I will tell you two things. One, be there. As I said at the beginning, you got have to be there. You have to talk to them because someone else is if you're not about their issues and they could be conflicting. The second, I'll go back to the first point you make. Always be honest and come in not with your checkbook, which usually everybody else has, and that doesn't get you as far, but your analysis and understanding and your honesty about what it will mean for their constituencies, not just in Washington, D.C., of course, but back in the districts and the states that they come from. And when you do that, you get their attention. And when you do that, you help the people that you work with.
And do you think there's a growing recognition among CEOs and business leaders that the reality is they may not like it, but decisions that are being made in Washington every day can have a profound effect on their company, on their ability to operate, on their own balance sheet, and they got to be at the table.
There's no doubt you're right. And in fact, I thought you were going to ask me that question first. I get asked a lot, which what's the difference between a CEO's role today? In the old days, you really had to know your business. You really had to understand your industry. Today, when I sit at some of the boards I'm on, and we go through our top risk, through our enterprise risk management, most of our risks, most of our biggest concerns are externalities that are not within our company, whether it be risk of a cyber attack, whether it be risk of supply chain limitations or export controls, whether it be policy changes that from one administration could swing to the other, whether it be not just in the United States, but of course in Europe and Asia and other governments, what they're doing. If you don't, as a CEO, understand the environments from the policy perspectives in those regions, in those areas, then you won't be able to craft your business for the long term because you won't understand where the business model's going and what the market's going to look like. And if you don't do that, then of course you wouldn't be successful long term.
Well, and how much does it change or should it change if, you know, depending on the party in power? So the historic presumption is, well, the Democrats are in power, they're going to be all over business, they're going to overregulate and raise taxes. Republicans are in power, we can back off and they'll be friendly to business. Does it change the calibration depending on who's in power, or do you need to basically keep pushing through no matter who's leading the government at the time?
It absolutely is a requirement, in my view. If you want long-term success, you've got to be the long-term committed to the government, no matter who's in power. And most importantly, you don't over-pivot. And you will see either business models over-pivot. Maybe, for example, in the Inflation Reduction Act, everyone poured all their money into legislation right. That was empowered by certain incentives. Well, if it was just government providing incentives you did it for, well, a lot of those were taken away. You're going to see a lot of things happening this administration that if you just did it because they are putting incentives in place, that may go away. So having people like our teams and what you did and really understanding how government works and building those relationships, like financial capital, you build human capital.
Right.
You deposit so you can withdraw it when you need it. So you have to be in there through each administration, know all the people, their power is going to shift back and forth. Eventually, you're going to need to work with both parties.
Well, and isn't it about the long-term credibility? Because I think for a long time, a lot of companies showed up. They said, okay, we need this tax break. Or, the number of tax debates you've been through, and now it's showing up as a credible partner to think about what is the kind of expertise and resource you can bring to broader problems that are not just about your company or your parochial interests and playing on in those areas.
You're spot on. I mean, you could go in there and argue for something that's really good for your company, and it may be good for your employees. It may be great for society. But realistically, you're doing that along with everybody else in the country, individually and as a company. So what's the difference you could bring to that room? You understand the problems that the people on the other side of the table, the policymakers, are dealing with and help them solve their problem with your solution that, by the way, benefits your situation.
Right.
And that's like a business negotiation. That's not even a government, non-government. That's common sense, but people don't necessarily think about it that way. Never go in there just saying, here's all the problems and things you're doing wrong. But when you go to Washington, understand what their objectives are, understand what their priorities are, understand what their goals are, and you come up with a solution that works within that, you're going to get a much better chance to have it done.
Well, and as you know, I mean, my boss, Jamie Dimon, has spent more time over the last 10 or 15 years talking about the earned income tax credit, which doesn't have any direct relation to a bank, but he just thinks it's the right thing to do to incentivize work and to get more people into the economy. And I think people respect that he's actually out there advocating for things that will actually improve the economy and help create opportunity, not just things that are going to necessarily help JP Morgan or not.
Yeah, absolutely right. And that's true. But if you talk to Jamie, as you do all the time, you'll know also he understands that our license to lead as CEOs are dependent upon this closing this income inequality gap.
Right.
And by the way, we're 70-some percent of our economy is driven by consumption. And if we're leaving people out because they don't have enough money to consume, it hurts the banking system. It hurts the whole country. So even, you know, even though it is a morally the right thing to do, it's also good, as you pointed out, for business, and it's good for society.
Let's pivot, because you spent, how many countries did you visit as chair and CEO of EY?
Well, we were in 150. I didn't visit all of them, but
I'd say over 70 or so.
Yeah,
that's a lot.
Yeah.
So, I mean, what you know, 10, 15 years ago, a lot of companies were waking up to the fact they had to pay attention to Washington. In the last few years, you have a lot of companies waking up to the fact that things that happen in the Middle East or in Europe or in Ukraine or in China can also have a huge impact on their companies. How do you see CEOs and companies thinking about geopolitics now, not just U.S. politics?
Well, whether you're in each of those countries, Peter, as you know, or whether you have a supply chain that comes from those countries, or whether you have customers in those countries, or whether you had shared problems like cyber attacks or environmental issues with other countries, you have to be around the world because they're going to affect you even if you think they're not. And so for the longest time, I believe that you have to be engaged with the governments of those parts and your regulators and your customers in that part of the world to understand things. Even though we are talking about deglobalization, we're really not going ahead and all coming back just within our country. Nobody could afford to do that. We couldn't make products and goods. Wouldn't have enough people, wouldn't be able to do it cheap enough. But we're changing the way we build our supply chains. And if you want to understand when you're putting a huge investment in the Middle East or in China, where they may be going, or in Europe, for example, you're seeing a lot of companies pull out because of regulations around environmental issues and others, and especially the chemicals industry, they can't afford to be there anymore.
I want to ask you about one other substantive area and then bring it to close. So you've spent a lot of time on workforce. And the reality is, you know, the change is going on in the makeup of our workforce and how people work. You know, we went through the whole with COVID, you know, are people working from home? Is it hybrid? As you know, my boss has some very strong feelings about that.
So I've heard.
Yes. But now we've got AI coming on and the potential. How do you think about the future of workforce and the changes? Do you think anyone's really sort of gotten their arms around it at this point?
I don't. I think this is globalization 2.0. When we realized, you know, we had the peace dividend and we were lucky, Peter, right? Because through most of our career, we had growth in our businesses because we found great supply chains, brand new customers over in Asia and other parts of the world that we can sell to. And everyone started trading with each other and building companies that were intertwined. And so we got this peace dividend and massive growth. But what we didn't realize when we were putting some of those jobs in India and other countries across the world, we didn't do an adequate job of training and upskilling our people across much of the United States. That led to this whole issue of not enough manufacturing, certainly advanced manufacturing here, and we left a lot of people behind in this income inequality. This is 2.0. We're going to have massive opportunities with AI, with technology, to use it differently, to reach parts of the world that we couldn't reach before, to get people from other parts of the world who could sell products into the United States that don't even have to have a presence here. Well, while we're doing that, a lot of the traditional jobs obviously will need new and different skill change. What I always have said, we won't really lose jobs. We're going to lose tasks and skills. Right. So people will have to do the job differently. And a warehouse today isn't moving boxes. It's operating software, right? So how are we training our people for that next job, the next way we're going to work? We haven't figured that out. And this comes back to what you said, and I think where our region is going to be really important, is that partnership between the states, the district in our case, the federal government, and the private sector. None of us could do it alone. We all have to come together to build that multi-talented task force with the right skills and the right jobs to be able to build that growth.
Well, and you know, one of the interesting things is, as you recall, when we were actually having conversations about, even before the creation of the Greater Washington Partnership, the single biggest issue that every business leader, literally from Baltimore to Richmond, was talking about was workforce. How do we train the people, how do we grow the workforce in this region? How do we attract workforce into this region?
And that's the key question that you and so many others have really, when you had the vision of Greater Washington Partnership, put your finger on it early, which is that it's the soft power, right? It's getting the mobility of our people across the entire workforce. It's getting the huge benefits of universities that do different things, from the technology sector maybe in Virginia to the bio sector up in Maryland to the hospitals, you know, and to the universities in Washington. It's the housing, having affordable housing, that when most of our people don't work in the state that they live. So you have to have transportation and affordability for housing factors that cross our borders to bring and make us the most attractive place to work in the world. If we do that, we're better than anybody. If we don't, then we create barriers.
I know you spend a lot of time with young people. What's the advice you would give as people are thinking about the workforce and their careers? What's the kind of, I know there's never one piece of advice, but what's a piece of advice you would give to young people who are thinking about their careers in this very rapidly evolving workforce landscape?
Well, first I would say, you know, be the CEO of your own life. You know, you've got to make decisions for yourself based upon not what you want to do, but who you want to be. And so think about that. And then, you know, who are the people in your lives that are going to help you get there? And so I think of it as a business, Peter. So as an individual, I think you should have a purpose. What's your purpose? Like, a company should have a purpose. You should have a strategy on how you're going to get there and whatever that means. And my strategy changed a lot. You keep changing it. And you should have your own board of directors, which I've always had you and people like you that I can go to and say, I'm thinking about this job. What are the upsides? What are the downsides? And remember, the world is really good at finding our limitations, but only we can find our opportunities. So I think you've really got to take risk, calculated risk, by talking to your board of directors, sticking to your strategy, following your purpose, and don't just let your life go on autopilot. And so be that CEO of your own life.
Well, and I think one of the things you said, you know, the one constant is change. And I see this in our hiring at JP Morgan. It used to be, do you know how to do PowerPoints or do you know Excel sheets? Now it's, okay, one day you're working at home and this day you're in the office and we have a new technology, and you have to constantly be changing and adapting and learning. And there's some people who are suited for that, and some people have challenge with it. And I think the people who actually can deal with this constant change are gonna do pretty well and accept the fact whatever you start with, it may be very different, you know, a year or two down the road.
Absolutely right. And that's why I do think, I mean, it's underrated. It doesn't show up on your academic tests, but your ability to network, and I use network in the best means possible. I don't mean using it to get ahead. I mean using it to learn, using it to hear about opportunities, using it to meet people and help them. It's a privilege. You know, a lot of people say, I don't have time to network. I've got to do my job. Well, no, it's a privilege, and it's a big part of your job.
I remember once Jen Piepsacker, you know, who is now the chief operating officer of our company, was the CFO. When she was the CFO, I said to her, what do you think about being the CFO? And she said, you know, I didn't realize how much more important EQ is than IQ, which is, you know, being the CFO of one of the largest banks in the world, you need some IQ there. But she said, it's, you know, it's knowing what you have to know and know what you don't have to know, and how you deal with people, and how you prioritize, and how you kind of run your, how you lead is much more important than just knowing, you know, all the numbers and the balance sheet.
So it's a great, not surprised Jen would have that great insight. I'll leave you with this last thing about leading, because we get there. When you flip, we've talked a lot about early in your career, what do? When you flip from manager to leadership, that's a very big change.
Yes.
And the biggest thing when you make that flip, what I see is now you're not anymore having the answers, but you're asking the questions. And that's when you're a true leader. When you know what questions to ask, you ask those questions, you help people think differently, you have now moved from that person doing the work to someone who could create the future of the firm. And the only way you get there is if you create capacity, as you said, because you need, you know, every time you work on your inbox, that's somebody else's outbox. You're not getting to your outbox. You're just doing their work. So you need to have that great team, and that team has to be diverse, as you know. It has to be, you have to engage with the team members, you have to enable it, but most important, this is the hardest thing I found for leaders to do, is empower other people and then hold them accountable. Because we're so used to doing, when you let other people do it for you, it's hard.
Yeah.
And that's the only way you're gonna get to do what you want. When you get that high up there as a CFO, you're not gonna give anywhere else if you're doing all the work. So you have to empower people. That's a great lesson for leaders.
So let me close. You've lived in this region and worked in this region, raised a family in this region. And this is the same question that is asked of all the guests. If you had to place one bet, bold bet, on the future of this region, what would that bet be?
I would say dual purpose AI and biotechnology is our gift here. When you look at the skills we have from our universities that we have, the international inflow of people that we have, when you look at the fact that the biggest purchaser of most all of defense and AI is the national, is the government, the federal government that's sitting right next to us. When you look at the technology that was born here, particularly in Virginia and moved out across the region, and now what we're doing in Maryland, and you look at all of that, and you can make that work together, and you could bring that, the bio side from Maryland and the tech side from Virginia and the policy side in the Washington area, and you have this great customer and this great research lab sitting right at your back doorstep, not just the university, but the government.
Right.
You could beat anybody. And I think we've got to pull that together, one region, and that would be my bet.
Yeah. I think, I mean, you look at the assets in this region with not the future of, as you say, of technology, of biotechnology, defense, all these issues, healthcare is all going to be decided right here. And we have the assets. You got the government sitting here. You got the private sector sitting here. You have this universities. You have really smart people. It's a great place. We got a great restaurant scene. We got a good, pretty good sports scene, depending on the year. And I think we're all excited. So I just want to say you have been a great friend and mentor to me for many years. You are a great partner to go to Bruce Springsteen concerts with.
That's our secret.
Okay. We could edit that out. And this has just been a lot of fun. So Mark Weiber, thank you so much. And thank you for having us.
Peter, anytime, any place. Thanks.
Thanks for tuning in to Strategic Compass. We hope you'll join us next time as we continue our conversations with the bold Greater Washington area leaders shaping the future both locally and nationally.
Subscribe to Strategic Compass today and follow us for more insights from the corridor's most influential leaders, helping you stay informed and inspired.